From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. With a woman serving as Secretary of State, a woman Chief Justice on the Utah Supreme Court, and three women just named winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, Utah girls have plenty of role models to look up to. But the reality, of course, is more nuanced than that. Research shows media messaging is all about being fashionable and pretty. And many girls shy away from math and science classes not because they're too hard, but because they don't want to deal with the isolation and social stigma attached. Today on the program, navigating the complicated world of girlhood. Plus, an update from Occupy SLC. The anti-corporate greed movement set up camp last week in Pioneer Park. Just who are the 99%? What do they want? And how can they get it? All that plus your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pearson. This is City Views. Most Utah girls will enter the workforce at some point in their lives, and the prospects have never been brighter. More girls in Utah are graduating from high school. Women are making inroads in many fields, but Utah still ranks dead last in the nation when it comes to women finishing college degrees, and women still earn about 77 cents on the dollar of a man's wage. Why the high college dropout rate? Why are girls steering clear of science and math? What more can be done to help girls pursue their dreams? Joining me now to talk about the opportunities for Utah girls and the obstacles that still remain, Irene Ota is the diversity coordinator and a diversity instructor for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. She's the keynote speaker at the Defining Your Path Conference, a seminar for 8th grade girls being held this weekend at the U. And Irene Ota joins me in studio. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Also with us, Barbara Kessel, a PhD student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah, and her research focuses on issues of gender and education. And Barbara is here as well. Barbara Kessel, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we invite you to join the conversation. Do your daughters feel empowered or pressured? And how can parents, teachers, and mentors help girls discover what's right for them? If you'd like to chime in, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. I want to start with your personal experience to begin with. Irene Ota, I understand that you grew up in Salt Lake's Japantown. And as a girl, as a teen, what kind of messages did you get from school counselors, from your family, from teachers about education and about professional pursuits?
You know, what's interesting, of course, I'm a lot older, so I'm back in the day where if you were going to K through 12, you couldn't wear pants as a girl. As a female, you had to wear a skirt or a dress, and it didn't matter how cold it was outside. So I'm from the other generation, but and growing up in Japantown, my parents being immigrants, we were also poor, lower class. It really impacted how teachers viewed me, being poor, having parents that were immigrants. People didn't have the high expectations for me that I wouldn't be able to go to college, that maybe I should learn a trade, go out and help my poor immigrant parents survive in the United States. And it was an issue of survival many times. Also because of the Japanese cultural view, which said that women should be home and take care of their husbands and be more subservient, particularly to their fathers. That played a part in how I grew up as well. And so there were things that I knew that I wouldn't or shouldn't do, right, because of what my parents were telling me. They had very definite ideas of gender roles, what my brothers would do and what I would do. And also my mother would actually help support my brothers through college. My parents did. But for me, I had to do it on my own because, after all, I was just going to get married and my husband would take care of me.
Mm. Barbara, I understand you're from North Dakota. Were you encouraged to live your dreams?
I think that I definitely got, I think by my parents, absolutely. I loved school. I was good at school and I got a lot of encouragement from my parents and from teachers. My parents were old enough to be my grandparents, so they were from an older generation. They hadn't gone to college, and they knew that I loved school, and I think that they encouraged me to go to school if I wanted to, but in terms of college, but I was going to have to figure that out on my own. So I think that I got a lot of positive messages in some way, and I also grew up in – I graduated from high school in 1990, and so I grew up during a time, I think, when the media was really starting to talk about opportunities for girls, and there was a lot more focus on kind of some of the ideas of girl power. And so I think that media messages made it seem like there were a lot of opportunities available as well.
Hmm. I want to juxtapose these experiences with what you see today. And let's start with the media, since you brought it up. How are the messages that girls get today through the media, how is that different from the land of opportunity that you had? And Irene, your experience. Irene, let's start with you.
Well, I did graduate from high school in the 70s, 1970, and that was at the very beginnings of the feminist movement, particularly in Utah, which is, you know, a little behind. But it seemed, though, that the message was we could do everything and we should do everything. And that's not the message that was sent to males, right? They weren't supposed to do everything, like raise the children, cook and clean. So women could do everything. They could do all that and plus find work. And it was the supposedly sexual revolution. And so women were also sort of given permission to be more sexual and have more sexual experiences. But it was still an overwhelming, confining sort of image that if you wanted to do it, you had to do it all. There wasn't, I could be a career woman and not have a family and not clean and wash and not do all that and take care of my husband. All of that was still expected at that time. There was that perfume, Anjali, that had a song, right?
I can bring home the bacon.
Yeah, can go out and earn the bacon, bring it home, cook it in a pan, and make my man still feel like a man because I'm a woman, W-O-M-A-N.
Barbara, media messages today, what are girls hearing that maybe we didn't hear growing up?
I think it's a little more complex. I don't remember hearing so many of the so much of the competitive stuff between girls that I think the media circulates a lot more now. So I'm thinking of movies like Mean Girls, where girls are constantly in competition with each other, and not just in terms of being popular, but in terms of academics and in terms of getting the guy. And so I think that girls are often pitted against each other now in a lot of the mainstream media representations. Hmm. I certainly think that the media portrays this image of girls as successful and powerful and having the world at their feet. And you know, for most girls, it's a little more complex than that. Life isn't just as simple as if you want it, go grab it. And I think that also kind of sends a message that if you are not successful or if you're having difficulty, maybe there's something wrong with you. And so
personal. It's personalized.
Right. And then, you know, you have to go get help or get fixed. And there are all kinds of books and magazines and articles about how to do that. So I think there are a lot of I think those things were around when I was a kid, but I do think that they're more complex now. And I just think that they're really contradictory in a lot of ways.
Barbara Kessel, a PhD student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah. Also with us, Irene Ota, diversity coordinator and diversity instructor for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. And we're talking about girls and growing up girl in Utah. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Irene, before we came on air, you were telling me that a teacher discouraged you and laughed at you for wanting to go into wood shop. I'm wondering, do girls today feel those barriers in school? Are they getting the message from teachers, look, this isn't the place for you, you know, physics is going to be too tough for you because, you know, you're never going to use this in your practical life. Are those messages still there in the school environment?
I think so. And as Barb said, there are overt and covert messages about where girls or females should be in academics. And it's not just in the schools, it's outside the schools. I mean, it can come from family, community. It comes from dominant discourse. It comes from media about where girls should be, particularly where girls should be if they want to marry, if they want to have families. There's lots of research that shows that women who go into, say, education to get their PhDs put off having children until they're much older when they have tenure, which is then you're pretty much more stable in your employment. The tenure system is interesting. I think it's the longest 7-year probationary period I ever heard of in any job. But for women, it becomes more challenging there. They can have their clock stopped to have children. But then after you have children, what are the expectations of the male partner versus the female partner in taking care of them? I think that all of those, Maureen Dowd, who is a columnist for the New York Times, talks about how women who are getting or have gotten their MBAs from Harvard will never mention it when they're dating. It just puts men off. That they look at it, as Barb said, as very competitive. So not competitive between females, but competitive between the male and the female.
Barbara, would you like to add to that? The complicated nature between being successful and being confident, and then this kind of sexual relationship dynamic that's there.
Yeah, I think that that's, when Irene was talking about the Anjali ads, I mean, I think that that's been a discourse that's been prevailing for a long time. Historically, women didn't used to be able to have it all because they were kept out of the workplace, and now you can have it all if you're willing to do kind of all that kind of stuff. And certainly there's a lot of discourse now about girls being too smart, too competitive, kind of outperforming boys. And I do think that the girls feel pressure sometimes to kind of dumb it down a little bit, because in balancing having it all, if you focus too much on academics or too much on being smart or too much on being visible in the classroom, then that might put your popularity at jeopardy. And so that's a balancing act that I think that that girls are having to deal with. And in terms of, the earlier question you asked about, what kind of messages girls are getting in school, in math and science classes, are they successful in those classes? And are they, I think that's very contextual. I think that depends so much on the school, on the teacher, on what a teacher sees as successful girl or appropriate classroom behavior. I do think that those programs are trying to encourage girls more to engage in math and science, but we still see that the numbers are not kind of what people would hope for them to be.
Yeah, I think there's contradiction from the outside as well. I mean, we all heard about the Barbie that said, math is hard, let's go shopping, right? That tells girls it's okay, math is hard, we know that, so let's just go shopping.
We're talking about girls and growing up girl in Utah. What do you think? Are the girls in your life feeling empowered or pressured? 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones. And Joshua is calling on a cell phone. Josh, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you guys are saying. In the culture of Utah, a lot of it is mainly culture built off religion. And in religion of the Latter-day Saints, we usually believe that, men have the responsibility of going out and becoming the breadwinners, and women are the natural, creative nurturers of children. And so, I feel like women have been given the counsel to go out and pursue education from the church leaders, but, men kind of have the big responsibility of, oh, man, we have to take care of kids.
Joshua, you make a good point. It is rather complicated. And I know that LDS church leaders have encouraged their members to marry young. But again, you mentioned church leaders have also encouraged young women to get an education, to go to college. So there is somewhat of a complicated message there. Thanks very much, Joshua, for the call. And Barbara, your response?
I do think that Utah is a unique situation, although not the only one in the country. So I think that religion also plays a very important role. I was sharing with you earlier that I came from a traditional Catholic family. And so I think that even though those messages might not have been as overt as I think that they are here, that certainly adds complexity to the issue. So then you have girls in Utah who are who have this kind of additional layer of message. So they're getting the pop culture media, which is just everywhere in the magazines they're reading. And a lot of that, of course, comes from outside of Utah. And then they're also getting a peer culture in school that's different because a lot of their peers are Mormon as well. And so I think that does add a layer of complexity. And I think it also gives us some better understanding of why we see Utah's statistics being different than a lot of the country.
Hmm. Counsel from pastors, bishops, Irene, has a tremendous effect on the way women feel about themselves, the way girls kind of plan and map out their lives.
Well, and then you talk about what is the ultimate goal and satisfaction for being a woman, right, in that context. And I have to say, they're encouraged to go to college, but for what reason? Is that to meet your future husband, who then will be highly educated, so to speak, and be able to provide for you? And you spoke about at the beginning how a lot of young women drop out of college. Well, why do they drop out of college? And what's interesting is that Utah has a very high female participation in the workforce, one of the highest in the nation, interestingly enough. And then you got to ask, well, what kind of jobs are they in, right? Pink collar jobs, and then low paying jobs, exploitable jobs, where they earn minimum wage at best. It's interesting the contradictions, as Barb was talking about, the contradictions that lie in even this community, this society here in Utah, where you're supposed to get married, have children, and be the nurturer and caretaker. And this natural, you know, your natural nurturer is again another, I think, it's another myth. It's another myth that promotes and condones and justifies women being the ones staying home with their children.
We're speaking with Irene Ota, diversity coordinator and diversity instructor for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. Also with us, Barbara Kessel, a PhD student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the U. And we're talking about opportunities and obstacles for girls here in Utah. What is your experience? Do the girls in your life feel optimistic about their futures or pigeonholed? 801-355-8255 is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Women are a majority in today's workforce, but how are Utah girls thinking about their options? Today on the program, we're talking about girls and education and professional prospects and more. You can join us if you like. 801-355-TALK is our number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. With us this hour, Irene Ota, diversity coordinator and diversity instructor for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. Also with us, Barbara Kessel, a PhD student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah. And let's go back to the phones. And Alicia is joining us from Salt Lake City. Alicia, welcome.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Hi, yeah. I think this is a great topic today. And I just wanted to clarify, one of your guests was just saying it's more of the that possibly some people are encouraged to go to college in the LDS religion to meet their husband. And I am LDS, and just want to say that's not my experience, that we're encouraged to go to college to support ourselves, because you never know what's going to happen in your life, and you're encouraged to get an education for your own benefit. So just to make sure that's out there, not clear.
I appreciate the clarification. Alicia, tell us about your experience in school. And did you grow up in Utah? Were you encouraged to pursue a secondary degree?
Definitely. Well, I have a bachelor's degree. I grew up in Utah, and I'm going actually back to school now, but for higher, more education. But yeah, I mean, that has been my experience. My experience has been very encouraging, and getting an education, the importance of getting an education for yourself.
Okay. Alicia, thanks so much for the call. I don't want to make this into a doctrinal debate, but I think there are some in this community who would say that, yes, you go to college to for the social aspects of it, for the relationship opportunities, and not so much for professional development. Am I right, ladies?
Yeah, and we can't. And I'm not saying that what I say fits everyone, right? What I'm saying is there is a discourse out there. There is rhetoric out there. I mean, we've all heard of the MRS degree, right? That what women go for their MRS degrees. That's a discourse that's out there. That is a rhetoric that's out there. So I'm not saying that that's for every single person. There's 301 million people in the United States. No, it doesn't fit all of the 301 million people in the United States. But there is a discourse out there. We've all heard it. We all understand it.
Alicia, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. And we'll go to Holly in Salt Lake City. Holly, hi.
Hi. Great program. I just wanted to talk a little bit. You may have covered this. I just tuned in a few minutes ago. But I'm in my early 50s, and I've had a great career all my life, as well as two children who are now in their 20s. And I'm a little disturbed what I see with, I think, a lot of younger women in their 20s and 30s right now who kind of get locked into this either-or trap, which is to say, I either have to have children and stay home because no one else can do any kind of child-rearing or helping in that way like I can, or I have to have a career and just not have children at all. And I spent my whole career doing both and, worked really hard to have great daycare and just tried to do both, did it quite well. My children have turned out great. And I just want to say to if any younger women out there are listening that the options are many, and I really truly believe that a woman can do both and be satisfied in both areas, and it can work out quite well. And neither one of these choices is a disaster if you don't do the other one.
Holly, I have to ask if you can't, if what I hear you saying is that you can have it all, and that's a message that I think a lot of women have had to reject because it's been too much all at once.
Yeah. Not all. I mean, I talk to a lot of younger women. I spend time in, like, talking in community forums and things like that, and college classes. And what I have said to women who have asked me these kinds of questions is, if what you mean by having it all is 100%, A-plus in both worlds, no. But, how many men have it that way either? It's really impossible, I think. But I think the best option and opportunity is to do both to the best of your ability and take joy in both worlds and just never lock yourself off from either one of these really great opportunities. If you want to be a mother and you want to have a career, it is doable. I absolutely believe that.
Holly, thanks so much for the call.
Sure.
Barbara, you were nodding your head during that comment.
Well, I think women's lives are really complex, and I think that there's often there is the tendency to try to put things in terms of either or, either you can do this or that. But I do think that there's a lot of pressure on women, and we see, so Sex and the City, the movie and the series as well, you see the way that series is ended with movies where women are kind of having it all and almost falling apart at times because they do have it all. So there are a lot of those pressures. But I think that some of the conversation that I'm starting to hear out there is, why do we have to have the sense that we have to have it all? So if I want to stay home, why is that not okay? And if I want to have a career and not have kids, is that okay? And for some women do want parts and bits of all of that, and some women, eschew most of it. So, I think that those complexities are out there, and I also think that there's so many other things in terms of class and the kind of jobs you do. So childcare becomes a lot more difficult if you're in, a minimum wage job that does not have flexible hours. And those are pressures that just kind of get compounded. So it's really difficult to talk about these issues in simplistic terms, like it can be this way or it can be that way, because a lot of it is very contextual and just more complex, I think, than we're used to talking about it.
Irene, before the break, you mentioned pink-collar jobs, and we're talking teaching, nursing, cosmetology. What's wrong with a pink-collar job? Many women find a lot of satisfaction in those areas.
it's not that there's anything wrong with them or that women don't find satisfaction. It's that that's typically where women are steered. Okay. And as you said, the pay differential in a occupation that is predominantly female is always lower paid than males. And even in a place like higher education, like the University of Utah, female PhDs will make less than male PhDs. And it's always because, well, not always, but I think part of the thinking there is that women will stop and have families, and they'll take care of their kids and their husbands if they have husbands, right? Well, as males, it's not expected for them to take to have their clock stopped so they can help with the pregnancy, the delivery, and then the raising of children, like women have to, right? Physically, they have to. They can't have a baby in their office and then go back to work. It's
although I've seen it been done.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's been done.
I want to, our time is running out. I want to talk about beauty, because this is a message that I see constantly in the media. You know, you must look beautiful. And to be honest, there is some recent research out of Harvard University that shows that women who wear makeup are perceived to be more likable, more trustworthy, more competent. So there is an economic payoff for that. How do we encourage girls to navigate that whole beauty complex? And Barbara?
I think that's tough. I wish I had the answer to that, because I think that that's something that follows girls and young women throughout their lifetime. I mean, you see now the amount of cosmetic surgery being done, and it's just astounding, really. But I do think that women are, and girls are doing a lot to try to negotiate that constantly. I think that what we do is, as parents, as role models, to say, you know, think of it as a performance. It's fun to wear makeup sometimes, but this isn't who you are, or, you know, that there's more to you than that. I mean, I think there are those messages that how you look is so central to who you are all the time. And I think the more that we can do to kind of dismantle that, the better we are. I don't think we're going to get around it. I don't think we're going to convince teenagers not to dress a certain way or to wear makeup, because we see that, you know, that women that are in their 50s and 60s are still kind of caught up in those things as well. And as you mentioned, it has material, it makes a material difference in the world. It's part of the game that women play when they go out and are in the workforce and are, you know, negotiating salaries and all of it. So I think it's more to just disassociate it from personal identity, and not let girls think that all of their worth is caught up in that.
Mm. I want to squeeze in one more phone call. Danny is calling from Salt Lake City. Danny, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, sorry. So my question is I'm just confused, I guess. Well, I've been experiencing this, but what I'm finding is that women are majority of the educated population, and now they're a growing percentage of the workforce. I'm just wondering, why aren't they doing better? Women are still making less money than men for the same job, and what can we do structurally to combat these issues?
I think, Danny, thanks for the call. The economic structure is a puzzle. There are a lot of structural issues that remain barriers for girls and for women as they progress into the workforce and in academics. Irene Ota, any thoughts?
Well, when we think about who are in the power positions, who can make these economic decisions, right? And let's talk about the real world, right? Let's not talk about politics, even though politics does play a role. But who are the CEOs? Who make these decisions? I mean, when you look at a particular retail store that refuses to let women be managers of any department other than homewares, stationery, etc., and you don't find any women who are managers of an entire store or district or anything, right? So women are going to be lesser paid. They are going to be subordinated. And we live in a patriarchal society. It's a patriarchy. Women don't have the power. Men have the power.
So what can be done? I want to offer some hope for girls out there, because really, I mean, things are bright. There are many bright spots to the situation that girls find themselves in right now.
Well, to, as Barb said, to not internalize it as personal, that I have to do this and this and that's who I am. But who are you? There are movements and class action suits that happen because women push it and demand their rights. And I'm going to let Barb pick this up.
I think that visibility is really important. So, I mean, I think the caller mentioned, you know, that women are still not making the same amount of money as men. And I think that that is, you know, that's a fact that needs to be continually out there. So even though women do have a lot more opportunities and girls have a lot of opportunities, those structural issues always need to be highlighted and paid attention to, because it's very easy to slip into this kind of feel good. You know, we have so many opportunities, and I want to encourage everyone to both kind of take those up, those opportunities up, and recognize that. But at the same time, keep a critical eye on the fact that things are still not equal, that there are these structural issues, that there are battles that need to be fought, and to keep those things in mind when you're voting, to think those keep those things in mind when you're talking, you know, to bosses, to legislators, all of those kinds of things. We can't let the guard down and just pick up those happy moments, because we know that there's still vast inequalities in society.
And also, can I add that there are issues of race. There are issues of socioeconomic class. There are issues of sexual orientation or sexuality here, ability and disability, that make this issue even more complex, that makes it so there isn't an easy answer.
Irene Ota, she's diversity coordinator and diversity instructor for the College of Social Work at the University of Utah. She's also delivering the keynote address at the Defining Your Path Conference, a seminar for 8th grade girls being held this weekend at the U. And Irene, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also, Barbara Kessel, PhD student in the Department of Education, Culture, and Society at the University of Utah. Thanks to you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Up next, the anti-Wall Street movement is alive and well in Utah, and we'll get an update from Occupy Salt Lake City. But first, a quick break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. In the weeks since the Occupy Wall Street movement emerged in New York City, similar protests have sprouted up in communities throughout the nation, including here in Salt Lake. Utah protesters have been camping out in Pioneer Park for nearly a week now, and joining me to talk about the message and the goals is William Rutledge. He's a student and Iraqi veteran and the media spokesperson for Occupy SLC, and he joins me in studio. And William, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Also in studio, Tara Beakey is a realtor, and she's part of the outreach efforts with Occupy Salt Lake City. And Tara, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
If you have questions or comments about the movement, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. I guess the question is, who are you? Let's put some faces to this movement. Briefly tell us your story, where you're from, a bit about your economic situation. Let's start with you, William.
Okay. I was actually born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. I got my first degree down at the University of Florida, class of 02. After that, I went to go teach for a little while, but somehow ended up flying drones for the Army for 6 years through a couple of strange missteps and adventures. After I got out of the Army, there really only the option for me as an aviator was to either go back overseas as a military contractor or, get a service-related job. There was not a lot available outside of military contracting. And what I decided to do is go back to school and, you know, work on a second degree right now. And I did start a small vinegar and pickle business that covers the bills. But I had the promise for when I started college back in 99, and when I joined the military, there was a promise of a lot of economic opportunity and good jobs. And, you know, having been an officer in the Army, they promised me when I got out that there would be people waiting for me to come back to take a leadership role back in the civilian sector. And that dream just didn't exist. Mm.
Another face of the 99%, Tara Beakey. Tell us your story.
So I grew up in Southern California and originally started going to college there. I was going to school for business. But when I moved to Salt Lake, to Utah, I wasn't a resident, so I really couldn't afford to go to school, just to be honest. And, you know, and so I thought I'll go back as soon as I am a resident and I can afford to go to school, just because it is a little bit more expensive. Well, a lot a bit more expensive to go to school here than it was back 7 years ago in California when it was very inexpensive there. Anyway, I was here just for a little while, to save some money. It's less expensive to live here. Cost of living was what brought me here. And I ended up getting a really great job with a good company, a small dot-com startup company, for sellbyowner.com. And from there, that grew. You know, the housing market was strong. It was before the bubble burst and was doing really well. And eventually our company was purchased by the Tribune Corporation, which if anybody follows that is in bankruptcy right now and has been for many years. And after it we were purchased by them, eventually one thing led to another and either my job was – either I was to be laid off or I had to move to Chicago. And at that point I was engaged. My husband has children here, my stepkids now, and I couldn't leave. So I had to let myself get laid off. And, you know, part of that was because of the financial crisis that we're in, you know, and part of that's also just because people don't read newspapers as much anymore. So I can't completely blame it on the financial state of the country. But, you know, it did have something to do with it because we were for sellbyowner.com and people that were selling their homes and, you know, that made a big difference. But, aside from that, because of everything I knew about real estate and what I had done, you know, for most of my life, you know, most of my adult life, I decided to become a realtor. And the funny thing about that is I came into it when the market had already crashed. Things were already difficult. So for me, it's just always been the way it is working as a realtor. But, you know, I've really seen a lot of people that did really well, and that's what they did their whole life was to be a realtor, and that's how they made their living. And that's kind of been taken away from them, you know, with how bad the housing market is. And so I see how that affects people too, because there's people that have, you know, that's how they fed their family, that's how they fed their kids. And now with, you know, being so difficult, a lot of them have had to go out and find new jobs, and they don't necessarily have a degree in anything else. They don't. That's all they've done, and so it's interesting to see and to talk to those people.
Hmm. What I see as a common thread in both of your stories is economic hard times. I mean, these are tough times to get by. So I guess, is that what this movement is about? Is that the core of it? Is it frustration with a down economy, or is it something more than that, William?
I believe that it's not. It is economic hard times, and there was a horrible collapse in 2008, and we still have a lot of there's still a lot of apprehension about what's going to happen over the next year as far as our economy too. We feel that it's been it's unjustly been the burden of the bottom 99%, as our pay is getting cut, as our benefits are being cut, the executive pay is skyrocketing. You know, the executive who does bad at his job gets the golden parachute, where us who've been working for years, we get our hours cut, our wages cut, our benefits cut. And we just believe that the burden of this crisis has been put unjustly on us, while the people who perpetrated it are actually doing better for themselves right now.
According to the Occupy SLC website, the goal of the movement is to end this corrupt system. It is broken. The plan is to assemble and organize so that we can collectively work to find a solution. Expand on that a little bit, if you would.
Let me see. What would be the best way to put it is, you know, as a whole, America, like you said about economic times being hard, I think everyone understands that, as someone was explaining to me yesterday, you know, the whole boom and bust cycle, we understand that that happens, you know, that markets are going to be great for a while and then they're not going to be so great, and our economy is going to go up and down. But the problem is that when our economy, you know, goes down and we have these big problems, we bail out banks, we bail out corporations, we help them, you know, and like William said, their salaries are going up. There has been no up for the middle class. Yeah. There's been, you know, nothing has gotten better. Nothing has, you know, if anything, it's just been worse and worse and worse and worse. And it, we don't see any change in sight at all whatsoever. You know, when they bailed out the banks years back, we expected them to bail out the banks and then fix the system. It was like the one time, let's bail them out real quick. Let's fix that and then, you know, get ourselves settled. And then we'll come up with a way for this to not happen again. That didn't happen. We bailed out the banks and then we just kept going.
If I can expand on this,
yeah.
We were discussing this yesterday about how with the large banks and a couple large institutions now, how their gains are privatized, but their losses are socialized.
Yeah.
And that
exactly.
And that these companies and these investment firms are allowed to make large risk because they know that us, the American populace, will pay for their losses. But their gains, they get to keep. And that creates an unfair system. And we actually, what's kind of ironic about this is that some of our critics will say that we're socialists. But actually, we have a wide variety of people in our movement. But actually, we believe that that's unfair. And we believe that that's, you know, in true capitalism, they wouldn't have socialized losses and privatized gains.
So you argue against the point that some have made that this protest is against capitalism, the very fiber of what America's been built on. Tara?
100%. And actually, a slogan that we've kind of started picking up is we're not against wealth, we're against greed, and we're not against government, we're against corruption. Most of us are small business owners that are out there. I am. I mean, I'm a realtor. I own my own business. You know, my husband owns a local business in Sugar House. One of the people on the outreach team with us owns a little coffee shop down the street. We're not against in any way, shape, or form capitalism. We're just against all the unfair advantages that majorly huge corporations have and the fact that we do bail them out and they know they can make these ridiculous risks and that, you know, it's backed up by the government. The government will say, oh, hey, we're sorry that you screwed up, but, you know, we're going to bail you out now. And we're not okay with that because where's the small business person who now, because of all the cuts in jobs, doesn't have their patronage anymore. You know, I used to have a little bit of extra money so I could go out and eat more often. You know, now those restaurants don't have my dollars going into their restaurants. And I think that, you know, the American people, the normal middle class working people, they need that support too.
Tara Beakey is with us. Also, William Rutledge, and they are with Occupy Salt Lake City. We're talking about the Occupy movement, their goals, their aims, their message. If you have questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or again, you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. The Occupy movement has been very clear to say that this is not a partisan movement. And that the protests are drawing people from across the political spectrum. And yet I have to say that the debate feels partisan at times. Conservative commentator Glenn Beck said, we are under assault not just from Muslim extremists outside our own country, but anti-capitalist extremists who want to tear us down. Many of them just want free stuff. Republican presidential candidates have been bad-mouthing the movement for weeks. Senator Orrin Hatch predicts that the rallies will become violent. What do you make of all this political rhetoric, William Rutledge?
I think anything about us being violent or turning to riots is just complete speculation. And that it is, it's unfounded. And when someone says something like that, I know they obviously haven't looked into this movement, but are making just a surface reaction. But what I believe is that actually, As we start to get this negative press or this negative comments from these presidential candidates and Orrin Hatch and Glenn Beck, it's because they feel threatened, because they have not been representing their constituents, because they no longer represent the people who vote for them. They care more about the lobbyist voice than their constituents. They care more about the dollar in their campaign fund than they do someone's vote. And when we come along and we say, that is wrong, You're supposed to represent your constituents. Your job, you're not doing it right. I believe they feel threatened. And so they make just extremely vague, uneducated insults about us. And they're nothing more than just insults. They have no they don't hurt us because they have no bearing on the truth of actually our movement.
So the Occupy movement feels disenfranchised from the political establishment. Is like you feel you don't have a voice at all, no matter what your political persuasion.
And to some degree, that's true. The reason that we say that we're not part of any particular political party is not only because we have people from all political parties that are a part of our group, but also because we just feel that the system's broken right now. It doesn't matter whether you're Republican or a Democrat or somewhere in between or somewhere completely outside of that. The people that are in office right now, most of them, you know, are pretty much bought and paid for. And that's how we feel about it. You know, the corporations, and that's why it's Occupy Wall Street. People say, well, go, you know, to the Capitol or the White House or this or that. And it's, you know, the people that and the corporations that are controlling the government are the problem. And the money that's in government is the problem. And so we can't say, oh, we're going to stick to this side or we're going to stick to that side. We need to come together as a common voice, the 99%, all of us, those that don't have a voice anymore, and speak up and say we need real change.
We're talking about the Occupy Salt Lake City movement, and let's go to the phones. And looks like it's Peter in Farmington joining us. Peter, welcome.
Yes. I had the opportunity to look just last week at the campaign contributions for Senator Orrin Hatch. There's actually a government website that shows this information for all senators and congressmen. And on Senator Hatch's page, he received over 80% of his contributions from financial institutions, insurance corporations, major industries, and surprisingly a great deal from the gaming industry. And I feel this is largely why there were less than a handful of convictions with respect to the 2008 subprime loan crisis.
Peter, point taken. Thanks very much for the call. William Rillage?
I think he makes a great point. I think that's something that the vast majority of this country wants is consequences for those who committed fraud that led up to the financial crisis, or at least a thorough investigation. And we believe that one of the reasons there hasn't been a very thorough investigation of the people who perpetrated this is that they are the ones who finance our politicians, who would be the ones who investigate this. So it's kind of everybody's has their hands in someone else's pockets, and it's hard. You know, we're just trying to get one person to take it out of someone else's, and then maybe we could get rolling.
Let's squeeze another call in. Peter, thanks for the call. This is Seth from Salt Lake City. And Seth, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Your question, comment?
I wanted to say, and congratulations on being a realtor. I'm an insurance agent, and I know how hard this kind of work can be. But one of the things that isn't seen very much, because a lot of folks don't have any experience with it, but this entire movement has affected folks' retirement. I can't tell you how many times I go into people's houses, and they had a $300,000 IRA they were going to live off of. It's now $100,000 if they're lucky. And I know there's a lot of political things, and we got to fix jobs and employment and all these things, but how a lot of folks don't talk to their grandparents about how they're doing financially. That generation just tends to be a lot more quiet about those sort of things.
So you don't see the Occupy Salt Lake City movement as just a young person's movement?
I see them as the ones with the energy, but I think it's something that everybody should be aware of what's going on, because a lot of older folks, even if they're not able to go out there, I can't tell you how many times people have expressed frustration with, my financial planner has lost me all this money. I was told I had this and that. And it's not just the big banks, but it's the guy at Citibank. It's the guy at Morgan Stanley that didn't really explain the investments right to the people that they were working with.
Seth, thanks so much for the call. We've only got about a minute left. I guess I want to ask you, William Rillage, how are you going to get what you want?
Well, we actually, here in Salt Lake, we decided to create, you know, our demand is that we've lost our voice and want to gain it back. So we're just going to start making steps in the right direction. The first way is we invited our city council, our mayor, some of our commissioners in town, the district attorney to come down. We're kind of having an open house Friday from 3 to 6. We're going to have some of our spokespeople speak. We're going to have some live blues music, and we're going to cap it off with a hopefully, I think it's going to be our largest march at 6 o'clock that night. But this way, we're inviting our elected leaders to come down not to speak to us, but actually to listen for once and listen to our voices. And we think that this is a first step in getting our voices heard again.
William Rutledge is a spokesperson for Occupy Salt Lake City. Also with us, Tara Beeke with Occupy SLC. Thanks to you both for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And I'll have links to their website on ours, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at CityViewsSLC. Tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson, so tune in for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.